Welcome to episode 28 of The Advent of Evolutionary Christianity, Conversations at the Leading Edge of Faith. I'm Michael Dowd, and I'm your host for this series, which can be accessed at evolutionarychristianity.com. Today, Greta Vosper is our featured guest. Greta is the founder of the Canadian Center for Progressive Christianity. She currently leads the West Hill United Church in Toronto, Canada, and her best-selling book, With or Without God, Why the Way We Live is More Important Than What We Believe, made Amazon's list of top 25 books that caused a commotion. She advocates, among other things, that the Bible is not the authoritative word of God for all time, and encourages churchgoers to drop dogmatic beliefs and to cultivate a heart for the well-being of all life. Here we discuss Beyond God, Becoming What We Believe In.
Hello, Greta Vosper, and thank you for joining this conversation on evolutionary Christianity.
Michael, it's wonderful to be part of this project.
I'm excited for you to be joining us, Greta, in part because you're one of the few Christian thinkers and actors in the world who get a warm reception not only from fellow religious people, but also from non-religious people and even sometimes religious skeptics. But even before we go there, I'd love for you to just share some of your faith journey. How did you come to where you are now, theologically or philosophically?
I am a minister in the United Church of Canada, and that's the church I was born into and have grown up in. And I think that has framed a lot of who I am and the message that I have and the leadership that I am able to offer to a congregation here in Toronto. Growing up across the street from the church, our relationship with the church was a close one. My parents were both involved. But I was going through Sunday school at a time that the church was introducing new ideas. And so the curriculum I used, or that was being used when I was in Sunday school, was the notorious new curriculum. Now, I say notorious because the United Church of Canada had been working closely with other denominations, partly the Baptist Church, in working on resources. But at the time the new curriculum came in, there was a hue and cry against it. It presented the Bible as a collection of stories that had been written to help us understand faith, to come to new understandings about God that were more in keeping with contemporary scholarship that was being read and taught in theological colleges between the 30s and the 50s. And this curriculum came out early in the 1960s. It taught about Jesus as being a model for our behavior, for living in right relationship, for being good, taught about God as love. Those were concepts that in many mainline denominations was still not, they were still not very welcome. But that's the milieu in which I grew up. And so I have an understanding of God that was very broad, even as a young child. Mm-hmm. When I hit theological college, which was a second career option for me, I learned that all those things that I had learned while I was growing up were ones that were now going to be offered to me in an academic setting. So at theological college, I was able to really steep myself in that contemporary scholarship that had informed the creation of the new curriculum and that brought me into contact with scholars that had very progressive understandings. So go from theological college into a typical United Church congregation and go about the work that I was doing and enjoyed it very much, and was in leadership in the church for just about 10 years when I had the opportunity to be in conversation with a number of different congregations, many congregations, in a conversation that was focusing them on their core values and core beliefs. It took about a two-year period to go through about 20-some-odd congregations with this project. And at the end of it, when I looked at it, I was astounded that even the people that I was ministering to and those that my colleagues who had been trained in the same kind of colleges were leading, that many of the people in those congregations, unless they had some of their own theological education, they hadn't got that contemporary scholarship even existed. They
Yeah.
still believed in a very supernatural, interventionist understanding of God as a being. They still believed that Jesus was the only Son of God, that he had died for their sins, though they couldn't really articulate maybe what that meant. And it was very, very elementary. And I don't use that word disparagingly, because I use it merely in that in our elementary classes in church, those are the things that many people had learned, but none had really moved beyond that unless they had actually intentionally done so. So I was flabbergasted, because I had been speaking about contemporary scholarship in most of my preaching, most of the interchanges that I had with members of my community, and I couldn't understand why people hadn't actually heard what it was I was saying. So I went back to my congregation and sort of thought, oh, I've got to figure this out. And the next Sunday started our service with a call to worship and a prayer of approach and sang hymns that spoke about Jesus being the light of the world and God reigning over all creation. And it was so obvious suddenly why people weren't getting it. I was spending 20, 25 minutes every Sunday, you know, reading a lectionary passage, explaining to people the context out of which that lectionary passage had grown, who had written it, why they'd written it, what the socioeconomic situation was, the political situation, the players, and why none of that had any connection with what was going on in our world right now, or if it did, picking up from that point and jumping off into something else, but usually just pulling in the last 2 or 3 minutes some metaphor that I could use to make sense of it. But I'd really missed what was going on entirely. And so that was when I realized I couldn't lead that way anymore. I couldn't be in leadership in the church if what I was doing was merely deconstructing scripture and reconstructing it in a way that really wasn't making it any more meaningful for people. So that's really where this project began, was in the sense that I was not offering the people that I was serving everything that I could.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. I've got to ask you to continue, because I think a lot of ministers are in that place. Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, the new atheist philosopher, published a survey of ministers who no longer believe in any of the otherworldly supernatural stuff in a literal way and are struggling with their faith. It's really an amazing study. I'll link it in my blog post to this conversation. But I think you're speaking the heart and the experience of so many ministers. And yet, what I want to ask is, okay, what happened next? Like, where did you go next?
Well, I did read that article, the work that Dennett had done, and part of me, as I read it, mourned the situation that many of those people find themselves in. Mm-hmm. I am so privileged to be in a community that when I went to them, and it would be 10 years ago now, that I went to them and said, I can't do this anymore, and these are the reasons why. And they said, okay, so where are we going? And I said, I haven't got the foggiest notion where we're going. Because I didn't. I mean, yeah. I just knew that I needed to have some more integrity and needed to bring what I believed together with what I was trying to create in that community. And so they, you know, held their hand out and said, okay, let's go. And we walked into this unknown territory together. So I have been very fortunate to work with an incredible group of people who, every time we've taken a look at the horizon and seen things that looked scary and frightening, have said, you know, well, we can't go back that way. So let's just keep going. And so that has created a very safe place for me to be able to do this work and the kind of place that I wish for all my colleagues who live that life of dissonance. We initially began looking at who we were and wanting to articulate a statement of faith, because we knew that we didn't believe the traditional stuff. Like many of us already, there'd been a book study active in that congregation for about 20 years at that point in time, and it had looked at a number of progressive contemporary theologians' work, John Spong and John Dominic Crossan and Marcus Borg. All of those had been studied some years before in that congregation by a core group of people, certainly not all the congregation. They knew the Bible wasn't the authoritative word of God for all time, and so they were ready to explore the implications of that. Because mm-hmm. once you say that, woo, there's an awful lot that we do that rests on that belief. So yeah. take that belief away, and what do we have, and what are we working with? So they wanted to sort of put a stake in the ground and say, okay, this is what we believe. And it was a very pragmatic choice to do so. If I had left and gone somewhere else, they didn't want to be taken back to some more traditional, more conservative understanding. So we sat down at the table and thought that we would start that process. But as soon as we did, one of the first things that someone wanted to put in it was, okay, we don't believe the Bible is the authoritative word of God for all time. Well, as soon as we wrote that down, we realized, well, there would be people in our community who might think that. And then it was, well, who do we think Jesus is? And as soon as we wrote something down, we thought, oh, there are people in our community who might think that. So we realized that we were doing what every statement of faith down through the history of humanity has ever done, and that's draw a line in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want to do that. So we wrestled with it a little bit more, and we talked a little bit, and we really recognized that what we wanted to do was be like some of those very early Christian communities that were called Christian in a very derogatory way because they lived differently than the people around them, because they placed values that they held in high esteem. They placed those values at the center of their communities, and they tried to live up to them no matter what the cost. And we recognized that what we wanted to do was really be able to be identified as people who lived according to some values that were really hard to live up to, but that we were going to mm-hmm. struggle with. And so we wrote instead another document that we called Vision Works. And that document has been what has really formed this work, given it form in these intervening years. That document was first celebrated by the community in 2004. In 2009, it was rewritten by a group, and I had nothing to do with the rewriting of it, and sort of waited in with fear and trepidation for what they were going to come up with, because I knew it was going to stretch us, and it does. I mean, we are stretched by that work and by the ideals and the values that we say we want to live by. And
yeah.
so once we had that first document in place, then whenever someone in the community raised a question about something that we were doing, we would take it to that document, which represented our choices, and we would measure it against what we had said we wanted to be like. And if it needed to be changed or removed entirely from the community's celebrations or its actions, then we did that. And that was where the real change started
yeah.
to happen and be
yeah.
seen in the community.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll bet that's where the change really happened. I mean, in some ways, it sounds to me that that document or those documents really served not just as the articulation of your choices, yes, that too, but also really an embodiment of your collective intelligence or your collective heart at that time.
That's a very, very nice way to put it. And yeah, I would say that's very true. The people who worked on it were from a broad spectrum of the community. They had been engaged in conversations. They had wrestled with ideas, and they wanted to put down those highest ideals that we could frame this human community with. The word that was used to describe it very frequently was daunting. It was a daunting task to try to live up to these things, either personally or as a community, and
sure.
everyone who was writing it knew that.
I'm curious, did you seek some kind of buy-in from the congregation? Was there some vote, or was there a presentation to the congregation and an offering of feedback? Or how did you get buy-in from the congregation, and so that this wasn't seen as sort of an elite group of people in the church making decisions that would affect the whole?
No, absolutely. It was the community that worked on the document. And the 2009 document can be found on our website, which is www.westhill.net. And on that website, you'll find a number of documents that we use. In terms of process, we had a writing group that was working on the original piece. when a segment of it was completed, we would take that segment, print it, and place it in the bulletin on that Sunday, and I would preach specifically on that item. Mm. Mm-hmm. During the week, we would have an opportunity for a group to come together either in the evening or during the day using exactly the same process and exactly the same questions. And we would take the feedback from those groups back to the writing group and then rewrite it from there. At the end of that, the document was completed and offered to the congregation. The board celebrated it and incorporated it into the work of the church. It wasn't actually embraced by the congregation in a protocol way, mm-hmm. in terms of making it policy. The board had made it policy. A year later, the congregation chose to do that as well, just so that we had the congregation's approval as well, though we knew that there was much in it that was already celebrated by the congregation. But the congregation was very involved in writing the document. When it was rewritten in 2009, the process was much simpler. We wrote it out with a working group who wrestled with it and then offered it to the congregation as a whole rather than each little segment of it as we had done in 2003 leading up to the 2004 document. And then that was embraced and celebrated by the congregation as a whole at a congregational meeting. And in reality, Michael, I do have to say that we suffered considerable losses at West Hill because of the choices that we were making.
Yeah.
We chose to create what we call a non-exclusive community. By that, I mean a community that will not present any beliefs that might exclude someone else. And that's very different from an inclusive community that presents beliefs in an attempt to include all the perspectives that are present in the community. So we have in our community now, and I'm very happy to say that the community has grown beyond the losses that we sustained. And so we're now a strong, vibrant, healthy community. And excited about the work that we do and engaged, and it's a very warm, celebratory place to be. But in that community, you will find people who are very traditional believers.
Mm-hmm.
You will find people who would call themselves non-theistic believers. They believe in something they would call God, but it's not a being, and it may or may not have any intervention powers.
Mm-hmm.
We will have people who are non-realists in terms of God. They don't believe that there's a thing out there, but they may, if they use the word God, they would be talking more about our responsibility to love. We have people who would never use that word ever to describe anything meaningful to themselves. They may refer to themselves as atheists, or they may prefer not to use any moniker at all.
Mm-hmm.
May not even call themselves religious.
It sounds not too dissimilar to many Unitarian Universalist churches.
Yeah, and I often get the question about, so what's the difference between you and Unitarians? And my response is always, why does there have to be a difference? Why can't we find the places that we, you know, that we celebrate the same things, that we're trying to live out the same things, where the compassion that I'm talking about is exactly the same compassion that they're talking about.
Yeah,
I think that our strength is going to be in finding those places where we resonate, where we have gifts that we can offer one another and celebrate in common. And religion, the danger inherent in religion is that it has always drawn lines. It has always built walls. It has always identified a group that is in and a group that is out. And it doesn't matter how multi-faith we can be and how tolerant we become, if we identify exclusively as a community and we have differences from someone else, we're still reinforcing that wall. It might be a little lower, but it's still a wall. So I'm eager to find ways that we celebrate and hold up the same common values.
Yeah. The word you just used, I think, is an important one, this idea of common values, shared perspectives is not the same thing as holding the same beliefs. one of the reasons why I was particularly excited about your participation in this, as well as other pastors who are working with congregations and really about the work of evolving church, evolving congregations, evolving Christianity in a real practical local community way. Ministers like Tom Thresher out in the state of Washington, Bruce Sanguin up in Vancouver, Ian Lawton in Spring Lake, Michigan. You know, you all are really on the ground doing the work of evolving Christianity and evolving church. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about this notion of shared values. And then also the distinction, I'd like to hear you say more about the difference between inclusive and non-exclusive.
Okay. When I was growing up, my mother dreadfully and unintentionally insulted one of my school teachers who was Jewish by saying that he was the most Christian man she had ever met. And the listeners will know exactly what I mean by the horror that they feel when someone says that. But we know what the intention is. And what she meant long ago, and my mother would never say anything like that now. She would be horrified. What she meant was that he lived the same values that she felt were inherent in her belief tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And those values, when we enter into conversation with people of almost any faith and people who have no faith, who are working to create a world in which all life celebrates and lives with well-being, we are talking about the same values. Our common language is values.
Mm-hmm.
And our belief systems are very different. It's kind of like they're culturally what we bring to our value systems. We've grown up with you doing it this particular way, singing these particular songs, chanting this particular thing, you know, praying in this particular way. But the values that undergird many of the world's great faith traditions are the values of love and justice.
Mm-hmm.
And compassion and forgiveness, and raising those up in a community and calling a community to live by them completely and immediately eradicates any barriers based on belief. So you can have a conversation about those values totally across any faith distinction that might be present.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we create this non-exclusive community. We speak about those values. So someone in my community who is a traditional Christian who believes in God and may even believe in a male gendered God would hear me talking about their God because I'm talking about all the things that their God would call them to do. I'm talking about living with justice.
Yeah.
And making choices that intentionally produce well-being in one's own life and in the lives of others, which is exactly what their God would be calling them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who is a total atheist, who wants to be in community that is building up and living out these values and helping them live them out, they hear me talking about the same thing. So we're all being, in some ways, compelled to live according to love, but compelled perhaps from different sources in our own understandings.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still knit together around these very common values. That's what I think the church of the future needs to be. Less and less and less about the ways that we articulate that are specific to our belief and cultural tradition, and more about articulating that in ways that can be accessible by all, so that our communities are the places that people come to be reinforced, to be strengthened, to challenge one another, to offer one another solace when we aren't able to live up to those ideals that we hold.
Mm-hmm.
And if church can be that, then I think it has a very important role to play in a society which is reducing itself to 140 character sound bites and losing the ability to talk about things that are important in the process of becoming so virtual and virtually focused.
Yeah. What you just shared, Greta, leads me to want to ask you about your book, With or Without God, especially the subtitle, Why the Way We Live is More Important Than What We Believe. Say a little bit about that in light of what you just shared.
Well, the title came out of the experience of my community, where people are in community who have a belief in God and people are in community who do not have a belief in God. So it's with or without God. The most important thing that we can do is choose to live well and to live in such a way that allows others to live well as well. So we get beyond the arguments over the peculiarities of our belief systems, and we get into conversation about how to live in right relationship with oneself, with others, and with all life on this planet, and indeed the planet itself. How do we live in right relationship with those others, those things? It's the I-thou conversation. How do we make everything holy, sacred, of value, and of worth in and of itself, so that we relate to it differently than we do when we're just using it, or when it's just an object that is there to satisfy our own longings and our own wants? If we can see the world that way, we see it very differently and we interact with it very differently.
Mm-hmm.
We also place ourselves in the position of deep risk, because we see the world as incredibly beautiful, and anything that maligns or harms that world, the people around us, ourselves, breaks our hearts. It's really difficult to live with that kind of an open heart. And so community then becomes also the place where that woundedness can be held, and we can hold one another when we lament the shortcomings, our own shortcomings, the shortcomings of the world as it functions. When we can turn our anger into systemic violence and injustice into life-giving ways of being in the world, life-giving ways of engaging and offering possibility. So we get transformed in community. We come in with our own understandings and our own attitudes and our own choices, and we're exposed to the choices that other people are making, to what they know about the world, to what their relationships are like, to the lament that they feel in their heart because they've come across some instance of injustice that we have never thought of before. And exposed to that, our own heart starts to bleed. And so we feel that deeply. And so community is a transformational place. And I don't think we can live without it. I think we have to have it. And the church is the place where that kind of community can be deep and rich, if we can get beyond that, you know, need to frame it in archaic language and present it in a text that too often can be read with violent images and read in a way that excludes and denies love rather than shares it as deeply as it needs to be shared in this world.
Yeah. Wow.
I think of the story of Little Lord Fauntleroy. And in that story, you know, there's this little boy who sees the horrific poverty in which the Lord, whose grandson, I believe, he comes to be seen to be. And he sees the poverty of these people who work on for this man. And we read that story to our children, and it tells us the tale about how we have to see how people in our communities are not well treated. Well, we live in a world where, you know, at this time of year, when I see all the beautiful things that brighten our homes and make our communities glitter with the glow of the season, I have to think of that story and the streets where those things are being made, and the people who are making the glittery Christmas ornaments and the fashionable clothes and all the beauty that makes us feel so lovely about this time of the year. Where are those people going home to? And what is the experience of home that they have? And are they being paid a living wage? And what will that living wage offer them in their circumstances? We live in a world where that's right on our doorstep, but we have to stretch our understandings of that world in order to see it there. And then that weighs on our hearts, and we have to live differently.
Yeah. what's striking me is that what you're talking about isn't just the evolution of congregations, the evolution of Christianity, the evolution of church. It's also the evolution of our species and how do we be in right relationship to reality, which is what I mean when I talk about getting right with God. It's being in right relationship to reality, the actual reality that we really experience in this real world, and that all of our spiritual practices are designed, they're meant to serve that, to serve us in growing in right relationship to reality. And if they don't, then I think we need to relook at some of those traditional practices and exercises that we call spiritual, that we call religious, because, you know, this idea that you spoke of living well and supporting others in living well is that. It's growing in right relationship to reality and supporting others in doing the same. And we as a species are social creatures. We're group animals. For 99% of human history, how you got a group to cohere, once you had verbal symbolic language, how you got certain scales of human beings to cooperate, was you had shared beliefs. And those shared beliefs set you apart from other cultures, other tribes, other groups that had a different set of beliefs that helped them cohere and work together as a group and sacrifice for the good of the whole and all those sorts of things. And now we live in a world where we know that we are one human species. And now we realize that the in-group needs to include all human beings, and where there's any injustice in the world, where there's any evil in the world, and when I use the word evil from an evolutionary standpoint, I mean pursuing one's own self-interest or one's corporation's self-interest or one's group's self-interest at the expense of this larger body of life, then those things need to be rectified. Otherwise, the body will be sick. It will be diseased. And in a world of weapons of mass destruction, where it's really easy to find them and get them, and they're very powerful, it's obviously not sustainable if we don't include as our understanding of our neighbor people whom our grandparents hated or feared. And so, you know, this idea of community being a transformative place, it has to happen in local small scales. You know, it's not going to happen in groups of 1,000. It's going to happen where there's a small group where you can be accountable and supported. And I agree with you completely that congregations are where that can happen naturally, and especially if we can move congregations from what identifies them as having certain mythic beliefs that we hold literally to having values that we share and perspectives that we're committed to and supporting each other in that. You know, I think that's the evolution of the whole shebang as best I can see it.
I think it's in those small communities that people are touched and moved to change, to be transformed, to transform their hearts so that they see the world differently. I see that we've kind of scuppered ourselves when it comes to evolving as a species, and we've done that through medical science. In my book, I give the example of myself being someone who would probably never have made it to reproductive age a century or so ago because of a bad set of lungs, allergies, systems in my body that function well because of medical intervention. So I wouldn't have reproduced and I wouldn't have two kids that now have a combination of different physical challenges that they've got from their dad and challenges that they've got from me. So as a human species, where are we going? Evolution has always been about the survival of a species in the environment in which it finds itself. So given that we're now, one, escalating a shift in our environment that we may not have been able to achieve the necessary adaptive physiological changes we needed to adapt to it in time, and that we have already, you know, saved and reproduced those who may not have reproduced before, we are becoming entirely dependent on technology for our evolution. It's technology that will allow us to survive as our climate changes. It's technology that allows me to grow to reproductive age so that I can have children and allows them to have children. So technology is a very significant and crucial factor of our evolution.
Yeah.
The question going forward is who gets access to it? Who has access to that technology? And that's the question of the future, is that ethical dilemma. Who gets to survive because they have access to this technology and who doesn't? We're already seeing a lot of that in the world, you know, where we don't have to worry about malaria, but there's a whole continent that worries about malaria, and we have the technical wizardry to deal with that, but the access to that is compromised by human systems. So already we're seeing the results of that technological evolution of ourselves as a human species.
One of the things that gives me some hope in that regard is that some of the richest people in the world and the most technologically sophisticated, people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and others, have a deep commitment to exactly the things you just articulated, to narrowing that gap in technology and narrowing the gap in access to various technologies. And yet, as I spoke with one of my guests about within the last couple of weeks, I forget who it was, this notion of transhumanism, humans becoming ever more symbiotic with our technology, and some people sort of knee-jerk think that, oh, that means that in a not-too-distant future, we're going to live forever or live for a long time, without thinking through that in a finite world, if all you've got is birth, but you've got people living a really long time, we're going to have a moratorium on birth. Otherwise, we're going to be overpopulated in a massive way very, very quickly. You know, most people don't get yet how sacred, how necessary death is at all levels of the cosmos. And they, you know, that's a whole other topic.
There's a beautiful prayer in the Faith Club from the Yitzkor, a Jewish memorial service, and it says, you know, what if we were given the gift of being able to live forever, but along with that gift comes the fact that there can be no new life, only us forever and always. No first love, no first job, no first discovery of a snowflake, no first anything. Could there ever be any question what our answer would be?
Yeah, and it becomes the question, is it heaven or is it hell? There's an Iroquois story, I believe it's an Iroquois story, that touches on the same point, that the tribe was given a choice by Great Spirit. Great Spirit said, you can either have immortality or you can have children. Choose. And of course, there was this big debate among the members of the tribe, and finally the grandmothers all went and sat in circle together, and after speaking with each other and being in silence, they came back and they said, we choose children. It is a choice. And indigenous cultures have always known that. When you have to live within the confines of a particular bioregion, a particular watershed, there was always a sense that population couldn't just grow. And now we're forced to deal with that as a species, because here we are on a planet with already 7 billion or close to 7 billion human beings. So this becomes a pertinent issue, how we think about death. And do we continue to see death as the enemy? You know, I mean, this idea of death being the enemy and should be overcome, and that if people die, it's a failure. Connie, my wife, has some real passion on this issue. She calls it intergenerational inequity, that we're keeping people alive in their 80s and 90s because we have the technology to do so. And yet, in many cases, the question isn't what's the quality of life. Does this person want to be kept alive, especially at this enormous expense to society? And yet we've got an entire generation of young people that are now shackled by debt forever. They're never going to get out of debt. And so this inequity of how are we spending our money, I think the issue partly is grounded in how we even think about death and dying. Do we see it as a natural process? Do we see death as sacred, no less sacred than life? Do we help people in their waning years to do what needs to be done, to have the communications that need to happen for them to die with deep peace and gratitude and trust? Not trust just that they're holding on to some otherworldly reward that finally that's going to make this entire life worthwhile, but that they feel trust because they're complete with their life and they've communicated gratitude and they've been able to communicate to the people that they've harmed or hurt or betrayed, you know, hey, I'm really sorry or whatever. And they, you know, they've had those communications because we have a different way of thinking about death.
That's very important, and I think that one of the reasons that we're having such difficulty is the low numbers of people who are actually in those kinds of conversations, and those are the kinds of conversations that church needs to have and allow.
Wow.
Since I have been out about not believing in the kind of afterlife that Christianity has always described, I have had deeper, richer conversations about death with people who are at that portal than I ever had before. I think because people before were afraid to say anything or express doubts or whatever, and now they know that they can talk about it and we can speak of death as gift.
Yes.
And how we can embrace it differently. So I think communities have to hold responsibility for those conversations and that will make a different way that we look at the world. I think that you're quite right that our frantic grasping at the last few years of life and squeezing time out, regardless of what the quality of life is or regardless of what it's costing future generations, is really something that we have to think about, and we have to have deep conversations about, and we have to recognize how damaging and detrimental that is to the earth as a whole and to the people that we purport to love, our children and our grandchildren.
Yeah, this became really upfront and personal for me because about a year ago I was diagnosed with serious cancer and underwent chemotherapy and had my spleen and a rather large tumor removed. And, you know, there was a period of about a month where I was looking at the very real possibility that I could die soon. And having this Christian naturalism approach to reality, that I interpret all of the what sounds like unnatural or supernatural concepts of my faith, I interpret all of it in a natural, this world realistic way, allowed me to look at the possibility that I could die, and of course the inevitability that we all will, but you know, that could happen soon, from a place of profound gratitude and trust. And part of that was because I had done the sort of spiritual work, quote unquote, of getting to the place where I didn't have any secrets and I didn't have any resentments and I didn't have any unfinished business. And so I felt complete with my life and my kids. I've got three kids. They were doing really well. So my genetic legacy felt like it was in good hands. My mimetic legacy, my ideas were still getting out to the world with my book and that sort of thing. So, you know, it allowed me to be in that place of gratitude and trust. But it also allowed me to not take any day for granted. I mean, when I saw a full moon, I wasn't assuming there was a whole bunch more that I was going to see. And so that's one of the things that I hope I don't lose, even though, you know, my latest CAT scan didn't show any sign of cancer. I hope I don't lose that real upfront and personal sense that life is sacred. Take every day, value it, it's precious, and don't take any of it for granted.
Absolutely. That's a beautiful way to look at that experience in your life and to see that there can be gift in it, to wonder at the beauty of the world and embrace it. And I think that it's in relationship that we get to celebrate those things most deeply. And those relationships that we build with people in our family and our friends and in communities, I think can buoy us, challenge us, and help us through those times. I'm not suggesting that death is not a time of profound sadness.
Oh, absolutely.
It is. It's hugely sad, and the losses are enormous for people. But it can be seen so differently than the ways that religion has presented it in the past, and so seen as part of life and a significant and very important part of it.
Yeah. Well, and it makes sense. It wasn't until very recently, historically, that we could have possibly known, like actually had measurable knowledge, what we now know about death. It's the death of cells in the embryonic stage of development that keeps us from being spheres. You know, it's the death of mountains that allows for healthy soil. It's the death of stars, supernovas and red giants that allow for the periodic table of elements. You know, on and on and on, what we've now known that ancient cultures couldn't have possibly known. So all they knew was death hurts like hell. It's horrific. And so the stories that we've traditionally had around death make sense. But until we grasp that death plays a vital and necessary role in an evolving cosmos at all levels, I think Christianity will continue to be shackled by unnatural, otherworldly notions of the gospel. I think medical technologies will continue to prolong physical and emotional suffering and provoke family discord. And I think the medical industry will continue to underwrite the widening gap between the rich and the poor. You know, to my mind, few things are more important than that, transforming how we view death.
And where do we do that? We do that in community, and
yes,
we who are leaders in the church are responsible for making sure that communities can have those conversations. And that's why I do the work that I do, so that the community that I serve and the community that those people create is a community that draws more and more people into that very important conversation and doesn't. You know, if someone walks in the door of my church, if they haven't gone to church for 30 years and they get up the nerve to make it into the church because something in their life is completely out of whack, either they've got a diagnosis or their relationship is falling apart or their kid is in trouble, and they think church might help, and they manage to fall in my front door. What's the learning curve that they have to get before we start offering them support? That learning curve needs to be completely flat. And so that means no technical language, no God language that means something that we all inside understand, but that person is going to hear as an interventionist supernatural being that is being prayed to make their life better. It's we as a community that can help make their life better. And we need to become what we believe in. And then with that strength and the recognition of that profound strength and beauty, offer that outward to anybody
beautiful.
And everybody.
That's great. I want to ask you, related to what you just shared, your next book is on the topic of prayer, and many people don't quite know how to understand prayer from a evolutionary perspective. So if you could say a little bit about how do you understand prayer in an evolutionary context?
First of all, I need to say that I went into this book really kind of kicking and screaming. I wasn't sure I wanted to write on prayer, but it was John Spong who said, Greta, somebody's got to answer these questions. And it's true that that's one of the biggest questions I get is, okay, how do I pray now? Or I don't know how to pray anymore. And prayer has been so important to so many people, and it goes right straight through the roots of our tradition, and it wraps the world in a multitude of languages and forms. So it's a really significant part of the life of anyone who considers them a person of faith. Mm-hmm. Of course, the fact that anyone who doesn't consider themselves a person of faith, that they can achieve the same goals and find the same solace and get the same strength without relying on prayer, suggests that one, prayer is not essential, but two, it's deeply important. So those are the two things that I try to look at in the book. And the question for me is, what has prayer been and what does it offer people who engage in it, who practice prayer? What are the benefits that prayer has given them as individuals? What has it given communities? And what has it offered us as a human species? And I've really fallen in love with the topic as I've written and as I've read and as I've learned so much about those benefits and how important they are to human society. So then the question is, once you realize what these benefits are, how do we offer them in ways that are sustainable in belief systems that are constantly changing and that for many of us are going to crumble? How do we sustain those benefits? What can we do? What does prayer become? Is it still prayer? Do we want to call it that? Should we call it something else? So those are the questions that I deal with. And the community that I serve, of course, we pray regularly. It doesn't look like what it looked like 5 years ago or 10 years ago. It probably doesn't look much like what prayer looks like in many other communities of faith, but the transformational energy within it is high, and I would say even higher than what it used to be. So we open our community prayer time by talking about how honored we are to participate in a tradition that is as ancient as it is, that is as diverse as it is. And we offer into that community our vulnerabilities. Individuals stand up and say what their vulnerabilities are, what their celebrations are. They wrap one another. We use a little response. You know, we used to say, oh, God, in your mercy, hear our prayer. Mm-hmm. That didn't work for us anymore. So we now say, in this abundant blessing, and the community says, we share the joy. Or in this our time of need, may love abound. So we still have a responsive kind. It still feels mm-hmm. like prayer mm-hmm. for people who have been involved in those kinds of communities. But the vulnerability is way higher than it ever was before, mostly because I was the one who was responsible for saying the prayers of the community before. And now individuals stand up and offer it, sometimes with a huge grin on their face because they're just so filled with joy at something that's happened in their lives. Sometimes with a quavering voice. Sometimes members of the community can't even understand what's being said. because they are so broken as they offer it into that community. But what you see happening is the community bearing witness to a truth that lies in the center of someone's heart and then being present to offer that person care and support or to celebrate with them what it is that they've offered. So it's an enormously transforming and very powerful time for our community. I would say one of the most important things that we do, even though it doesn't look at all like what traditional prayer looks like.
Yeah, wow. Well, I personally think that the work that you are doing, you and your partner Scott, the work that Michael Morwood, Jim Berklow, Bruce Sanguin, all of you who are trying you're taking this deep time, evolutionary, science-based, naturalist understanding of reality and giving it liturgical legs, creating songs and hymns and responsive readings and prayers and various kinds of tools that congregations can use that, as you say, are non-exclusive, that are liturgical, and that can touch our hearts because they're either ritualistic or they use poetry. There's just something about that kind of language and that kind of communication that can speak to us in a deeply emotional way and in a personal way and when we're in times of need. And so I am, for one, hugely grateful for the work that all of you who are creating liturgical forms are doing. I understand you've got some stuff up on your website with regards to that. Could you share with our listeners how they can access some of these tools that you and Scott have created?
Yeah, the Center for Progressive Christianity in the States is carrying two collections of prayers that I've written. One is called Holy Breath. The other one's called Another Breath. And those are collections of prayers that I write for opening our service. And they're all non-exclusive opportunities for a community to engage either in unison or to be led in those prayers. Periodically, I've thought that I didn't want to do that anymore because I'm not really keen on unison prayers. But people who get them in the bulletin clip them out and drop them in neighbors' mailboxes. They read them to their coworkers on their answering machines and stuff like that. So we still use them because they're used far beyond the Sunday service. Scott has a collection of, I believe there's 29 songs that he's written in a book called The Wonder of Life. That's also available, and that's www.tcpc.org that you can find those resources. Scott has an evangelical background, wrote music in the evangelical church in his younger years, and then his faith unraveled when he inadvertently took one of Marcus Borg's books out of the library and realized that so much of what he had based his faith on was a human construct, and so that unraveled. He didn't write for many years, but broke that logjam on the eve of the launch of the Canadian Center for Progressive Christianity when he wrote a song for that event, and that really opened him up to creating some incredibly great music. He's a phenomenal songwriter and composer, and people will really enjoy those very accessible pieces of music. Also available through TCPC is a collection of songs that we have put together in a book called Sing It Forward. These are all rewrites of traditional tunes so that they can be used in congregations that still use some of the traditional music and want to continue to use that. We have found at West Hill on this bleeding edge that one of the things that is best done early on is to shift the language without shifting the form. And if you're able to do that, people are far more willing to make the shift and to go with you. It wasn't until after there was an article in the newspaper and one in our national denominational magazine that people started questioning what words I actually used at communion. Now, I had been at West Hill for 7 years at that point. I had never used the traditionally recognized words of institution, but no one had noticed until it hit the newspapers. And then suddenly it was a concern that I wasn't using those words. Because that form is so powerful, that symbol is so powerful, what I was saying allowed people who couldn't hear those words, who would have been excluded if those words had been used, allowed them to come to be in community with us. So they then were included. And it allowed those for whom the symbol was powerful to continue to be there because they weren't being excluded by the loss of that symbol. So when it comes to shifting words of songs, I mean, sometimes people get, you know, I like those words, but our community who had moved away from a lot of those traditional songs and hadn't sung them at all because we hadn't changed the words, when we started changing the words and bringing some of that music back, the joy and the tears to have reclaimed something that they thought they had lost was really
cool. Yeah.
So those resources are available through www.progressivechristianity.org in the States and progressivechristianity.ca in Canada.
Yeah. Wow. Greta, I look forward to meeting Scott and to actually experiencing his music as well, because Connie and I were involved in the first evolutionary revival service down in San Diego a couple years ago. It was really quite an extraordinary event, and I see more and more of these things happening, these, for lack of another term, a revival service that's just dynamic preaching and dynamic music and just moves people's hearts and souls and bodies, and yet you don't have to check your brain out at the door. There's no part of you that has to say, well, I don't really believe that, but I'm going to say this because I'm being expected to. All of it's congruent.
Which is why I think this project is so important, Michael, because there are so many people out there who have not connected into anything because they don't think there is anything there that they can enjoy, that they can celebrate. And so they don't participate. They don't seek it out. And this project will give access to a whole different perspective to people who have been deeply isolated. When I was speaking in Adelaide in Australia last year, a gentleman came up to me after I spoke and he said, you know, I left the church when I was a very young teenager because I was going through some kind of classes. I think it was what we would call a confirmation class. And I was told I had to believe things that I refused to believe. And I have not been back in a church until today.
He's wow.
88 years old.
Oh, my God.
For that length of time, he wow. had been isolated. But the fact that he came
yeah.
meant that for all that time, he knew he was disconnected. And he
wow.
felt that isolation. So if we can touch people who have been, you know, maligned in their journey by the church, excluded, if
yeah.
we can touch them and bring them into conversation, honor what they believe, honor what it is that they have to offer us, what it is that they have to say, and the perspective that they have to share, I think that will be a very important part of our work. And so I celebrate this project that you've initiated, because I think it will do a lot to help people feel reconnected.
Mm. We'll just see where it unfolds, but it's very exciting. Well, Greta Vosper, thank you so much for your ministry and yours and Scott's ministry, and for sharing your perspective and your experience here on the Leading Edge of Faith.